from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made throughout our community each day at local libraries. According to local librarians, books are traveling between libraries at a rate that is higher than ever. Some of that is due to interlibrary loans during the pandemic. Some is due to more people entering library buildings again. Foot traffic is going back up. That is welcome news to library staff who have faced a number of challenges as a result of the pandemic, from staffing shortages, branch closures, to issues with digital content and supply chain challenges. Libraries are doing their best to adapt and adjust. But, you know, like, let's be real here. 20 years ago, there was a lot of talk that libraries are going to go the way of the phone booth, that our kids or grandkids or their kids would eventually look at libraries the way we already look at rotary phones and phone booths. That has not happened, happily. Libraries are a vital part of our community. They serve people in a wide range of ways, but that doesn't mean it's easy, and there's going to be challenges going forward. This is a good chance to help us understand the current state of libraries. Listeners, this is going to be the most exciting hour of libraries you've ever heard. I've got a big smile there from Laura Osterhout, who is Executive Director of the Rochester Regional Library Council. Libraries are exciting, right?
Yeah, you know it. They're doing all kinds of great stuff. Thanks for having me on today.
Thank you for being here. Adam Traub is here. Adam is Associate Director of the Monroe County Library System and Central Library. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Libraries are exciting, aren't they?
Yeah, darn skippy they are.
That's the first time we've had darn skippy on this program in a while. Adrian Petinelli, Director of the Henrietta Public Library. Adrian, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to welcome a librarian at Volmer Elementary School, Anna Canino. I'm going to say Fluit, but Anna, tell me if I've got that wrong or right.
It's always pitfalls. It's Anna Canino Fluit.
Okay, see.
I agree. We are libraries are the heart of schools.
They are the heart of schools, and I'm actually quite excited here because I'm glad to hear, for one, that two things are happening. A lot of interlibrary book traffic. People are starting to understand that the way libraries are connected, you can take advantage of that. And people are, at least from what I'm seeing, coming back out a little bit more. I mean, Laura, what are we seeing right now?
We're seeing so much. You know, so my organization represents all types of libraries. So types of libraries you may not always think about, you know, college libraries, medical libraries, hospital libraries, etc. And, you know, the pandemic never got any of us down all the way. We have been working hard, even when you can't see us, you know, behind the scenes moving materials around. And I think what we're seeing now, and it's a really hopeful sign, is more and more collaboration between different types of libraries on really important projects and things like digital inclusion. And we can talk more about that as we go forward.
Adam, what are you seeing right now?
You know, our Monroe County Library System offers, one of the services we offer is shipping between the public libraries in Monroe County. And actually, one of the most exciting things I've seen in the past couple months is we hit an all-time high since we started tracking in 2010 of holds being placed. So that's when a patron wants to borrow a book from another library and our trucks take it from whatever library it's living at and ship it to that patron's home library. We actually have seen those holds go up 7% since 2019. I don't really think comparing it to 2020 makes sense, but we are seeing that rise. And so we're starting to see a return of people borrowing those books again, which is really exciting.
Yeah, that's good news. Adrian, what are you seeing?
So last month was our busiest month since before COVID. That was really exciting for us, both from a number of items being checked out and door count perspective. And yesterday on, you know, the schools were off, but we were open. And it was like the good old days. So that's what I kept saying yesterday morning. The children's room was packed. Lots of families were in. We had story times. They were packed. It's really wonderful to see.
Anna Canino Flute is the librarian at Volmer Elementary. So how does that impact you? Has your work changed in this pandemic?
Oh, it kept expanding and changing throughout the pandemic. We always have been involved with like tech integration in our buildings, have working as tech coaches and such. But when we hit the pandemic, a lot of teachers suddenly had to learn how to do meets, how to do all that kind of stuff, and they turned to us. But also we did all that training with our students of how to access most of our digital materials. But I'm going to echo what everybody's saying. With libraries open again, our students have all come back, and they are so hungry for physical books because they've been reading digitally for school, for everything, for a year and a half.
And I was just going to ask all of you about this. So I'm glad you brought up the question of physical books. I can remember specifically where I was in my school's library in fourth grade when I pulled a book off the shelf called Dracula is a Pain in the Neck, which, you know, I liked dad jokes even in fourth grade, it turns out. That book, it set me on a path to wanting to become a creative writer. And I went back to that same section, and then I was looking for other books. And I mean, it was a big moment in my life that I can still sort of vision in my mind's eye. And I don't think it would have hit me the same if I was holding a Kindle or a Nook or whatever, a digital reader. And I don't want to be kind of the get off my lawn guy, but I would love it if physical books hang around, because I do feel there's something different, a little more tactile, a little more easy to connect with. And you seem to be hinting at that. The kids, even kids, are maybe reacting differently to screens and reading versus actual physical books, Anna.
Yeah, we have seen this consistently through the time. Like, I'm a big digital reader myself, but kids have always have a preference for the physical book. I think because it separates it from their school life where they're all, like in our district, we've had Chromebooks for many, many years. So this wasn't a new thing. So they're used to digitally reading, but the skills are different. There's more distractions online. They are, you know, it's just as easy that you may be on Epic reading a book or on Overdrive. And then you like, well, let me just check what's on YouTube. And off you go for an hour. Which is harder to do when it's just a book that you're holding.
Adrian Pettinelli, how do you see the difference that, well, kids and adults are seeing? I mean, are physical books eventually on their way out, or has that movement sort of slowed a bit?
What we see here is that the digital books seem to be expanding the number of people who are using the libraries and readers. So it really is not taking away from the physical book circulation, but really adding to it, which is an interesting challenge. But, you know, we're also seeing teens, little kids, they still like the physical books. So I think this has really got a future. The increases that we saw in ebook use when it was the beginning of the pandemic, I think that was mostly in adults and really retirees. So the kids still, I think that leisure reading piece, they want to hold the book.
Well, Adam, my dad is 76. He's read 150 books since the start of the pandemic. And I couldn't believe how many were on his digital reader. Because he's the kind of guy who reads, and if he finishes a book, he keeps it. And because he wants to see what he's read and kind of go back and reference stuff. But he is getting more into e-readers, which I thought, like, I was like, Dad, no, okay, hold the fort here. So I get that there's benefits both ways. What I guess my hope is that someone's going to tell me there's always going to be reading on screens, there's always going to be e-readers, but we're probably not going to see books themselves go away, Adam.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, we are seeing, as Adrian mentioned, an increase in the electronic circulation or checkouts of e-books across the county. It's 35% year to date compared to 2019. So we're on track to, you know, we're going to be scraping about a million checkouts this year. So it's still popular. And, you know, we are seeing a lot of that being leisure reading. We're seeing, you know, different types of material go out. Certainly parents who want to read through a bunch of storybooks and maybe don't want to read the same one night after night are borrowing at a high rate. But, you know, I know myself, I've been switching over to audiobooks for the first time in my life as well. But that doesn't, you know, stop the fact that I've got two books in process on my nightstand at home that aren't digital at all.
See, that's the future. That's what I'm talking about. Laura, how do you see that?
I agree with everything everybody's saying, and there's always going to be a part of me that when I see a physical book, it just makes me happy, because that's, you know, what I grew up doing is reading. But, you know, more importantly, I think for libraries, the physical books are easier to share. And if you think about digital content and the way that it's licensed and managed, it's really difficult to interlibrary loan something like that. And so the physical books allow us to share materials with, you know, throughout the region, throughout the state even, and get people more access to things and save money by sharing.
I hadn't thought about the sharing aspect, but that absolutely makes sense. I am I'm wondering, as you kind of look ahead here, one of the big themes that we had this summer talking to teachers was this pandemic forced everybody to do whatever your job is, just about, had to be done differently in some way. What is the good thing that you said, boy, we never would have done this if not for the pandemic, and we will learn from that and we'll bring that forward? And what is the thing that made you say, I cannot wait until this is over or close to over, or we're back to some sort of 2019 standard? And let me start with Laura on that. So first, what's the kind of the good that you want to take forward, and then what's the dread?
Let's see. Well, the good is in the work that we do at the Library Council, it's all collaborative. It is across all types of libraries. And so the good part is that the pandemic forcing all of us to go work and do everything online has made us just open everything up as much as possible. So like we do a ton of training. We do it all across the region, and now we're doing it across the state with our partners. So we're able to bring in way more experts for the people in the region, the library workers that need training. So that's been a real positive. And I probably won't be alone in saying this, but Zoom fatigue, Zoom, you know, while useful, is not how I envision spending the rest of my life. And that's what it feels like right now.
It feels like you're going to spend the rest of your life on Zoom?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Oof. No, I don't think so. I think, wasn't it amazing how, like, toward mid, late March, people were like, boy, this Zoom thing is easy. This is great. Like, I like it. And then, 2 weeks later, we were like, no more.
Yeah. Sick of looking at my own face on a screen. Yeah.
Adam Traub, what are the sort of the good to bring forward and the bad that you're ready to leave behind?
Yeah, I think the other side to that Zoom coin is we are reaching people in their homes a little bit better. I know one of the reasons we recently did a survey about why people don't use the library. We talked to non-users, among others, and it's that they don't think of us. So being accessible from home, I think, is actually a really nice way to reach people who either can't or might not otherwise have the time or energy to get to the library but can still participate. So I think that's kind of the other side of that. And then, I don't want to stare at another Zoom screen, anytime soon either. It gets old real quick and it gets real tiring real quick.
It's nice to be in person in studio today.
Absolutely.
Couldn't agree more. I'm still waiting for somebody to be like, I just want to be on Zoom forever.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. I know Mark Zuckerberg is sort of into that. Like, we'll live in this virtual world, but just him. Adrian, what about you? What are the good and the bad here?
So, on March 13th, 2020, if you had said to me, curbside pickup, we're going to do it at the library, I would have said, oh, that's crazy. It'll take us months to figure that out. The following Monday, my staff and I sat down and figured it out in a half an hour and had it implemented by noon. And we've continued that service. We've refined it since then. It's very popular. And we have people coming in and out all day picking up curbside. It's very easy for us to run. And what an enhancement to our services. So that's been a great thing for us. Yeah, I'm sick of Zoom, too. I'd say the thing for me that was so hard, and I know for my staff, was not seeing people for that period of time. It's funny because people think of libraries and they think of the books, but I think of the people, the folks who come in day after day who we get to know, and suddenly they're all gone. That was so, so hard. And it's been wonderful as slowly, slowly, slowly we see those people again. And, we have every day still people saying, this is my first time in since the pandemic started. And that is something I hope never to be in a position where I'm not seeing our community members in every day again. That was the really hard part for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Anna Canina Flute, what about you?
Yeah, one of the things that happened out of the pandemic that I think it's an awareness I want to keep is the fact that it shined the light on so many access issues, and the fact that some of our kids didn't have connections at home, that they would take the Chromebook back and forth, but they had no Wi-Fi, so we offered that, and that made us more aware of just all kinds of access issues. So one of the things that we have changed is that I'm building like a bank of tutorials. Everybody else in our district is too. Because we present in classrooms, we present virtually, but sometimes a kid is out, they're sick. Like we currently have a lot of kids quarantined. the teacher can push out that video on Classroom, and the student can access it in the time of need. So those kind of things have become like, how do I reach the kids who can't see me?
Mm. Yeah, well said. That has crystallized so many inequities. There's no question about that. I'm also curious to know if there is any parallel to what we talked about last hour. So last hour we talked about staff shortages in nursing. And the fact that, yes, that was building up before the pandemic, but that has accelerated some of that. And Laura Osterhout, do you, as the executive director of the Rochester Regional Library Council, do you see staff shortages? Do you see trouble recruiting, hiring, retaining? What's going on?
Yeah, everywhere.
Yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I reached out to all different kinds of libraries to get their perspective on this, and our other guests can speak to the types of libraries they work in. But across the board, staffing shortages are impacting everyone, certainly at the schools. Teacher shortages impact the library because librarians have to pitch in and do other things. I know I won't speak for Adam. There's, you know, things going on at the public libraries. At the college library level, staffing shortages are impacting people's ability to do maybe not basic services, but the add-on value projects that make library services better for the students and faculty. So the extra stuff, the special sauce, so to speak. So it's impacting everybody.
What can you do about it?
Well,
let me ask also another question.
Sure.
What can you do about it? But what's also driving that? Perhaps I'm assuming people leaving the field or. I don't know if it's funding cuts, overall program cuts. I mean, can you kind of paint that picture a little bit?
It's probably both of those things. You know, I think I can't explain the staffing shortages that are going on in the world. That's someone, you know, with a sort of higher level title than mine. But regarding budget cuts, that absolutely impacts libraries' ability to hire staff. And a lot of times what you'll see is there's only funding for a part-time position. Mm-hmm. And that really, you know, you can't just work a part-time position and sustain yourself. So those turn over faster. And then that turnover and having to retrain delays things. And it's a little bit of a cycle that if you don't have the funding to support a robust staffing, you're always going to be in that problem.
Mm. Adam, what are you seeing as the associate director of the Monroe County Library System and Central Library staffing-wise?
Yeah, I mean, of course, we have people who leave. You know, I think that the pandemic has just made everything in our lives harder. And I think it makes, and this isn't industry specific to libraries, but by making everything harder, it makes it harder to get to the grocery store. It makes it harder to get out of bed and go to work. And I think we're seeing that fatigue, you know, we're talking about Zoom fatigue, but that like pandemic fatigue build up to the point where people are like, it's not worth it anymore. You know, we had one position open that we, I think, had made three separate offers. We got ghosted on two of them. We didn't even get a call back. And, you know, it's getting hard not only to retain people, but also to recruit new people. And that, it, you know, again, you know, you talk about supply chain. It happens both on the supply end of being able to come to work, but also of people leaving for either other opportunities or just deciding to stay home because things are building up.
You're not, obviously, you're not the only one who has experienced posting a job and having applicants not even show for an interview or not return your calls. Some of these stories are really wild where people kind of, they take the time to apply for a job, don't even respond when an offer is made. Sometimes they just don't show up for an interview. Sometimes they don't call back. How far along, when you talk about two people ghosting, mm-hmm. what do you mean by that? Just didn't call you back or were actually offered a job? What happened?
An offer was made and we never got a call back.
A job offer?
Yep.
No call.
No call back.
Not turning it down, not like, hey, I need another X, nothing.
Nope, just ghosted.
What do you think was the reason for that?
You know, I don't know. You know, our jobs are public information, so salaries posted, you know, titles are posted. It's part of the civil service recruitment process. So
it shouldn't have been a surprise.
Exactly.
Right,
it shouldn't have been a surprise. Now, maybe they found a better opportunity because they were clearly looking. Maybe they found a better opportunity, and I hope that's the case. But unfortunately, when you get ghosted, there's no feedback either. So we don't know why the opportunity wasn't attractive to them.
Okay, wow. This may be me being get-off-my-lawn guy, but I will say I don't like that trend. I like more power for workers. I mean, I understand workers wanting more power and wanting to assert more rights and sort of tilt the scales back when it has been one way for a long time. But sometimes you could say no politely. Sometimes, yeah, sometimes you can call back or something.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think it's great that people have a little bit more control over their own destiny. But, from my position, I'd love to know why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Why was it not interesting? So how can we make that attractive to the next applicant?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even if 80% of the people who turn you down say it's not enough money, that's a good data point, right?
Exactly.
Of course, yeah. Adrian Pettinelli, what are you seeing?
So when the pandemic hit, we lost 3 part-timers the day it hit because they had kids they had to educate at home. So they just quit that day. And then since then, I've had 3 full-time staff retire. I had 2 leave and go to other libraries. So it's been a huge turnover for us. A lot of it, certainly the retirements were people who had been kind of waiting and then decided to pull the trigger. I think because of the pandemic, we have luckily been able to fill jobs, but certainly we've lost a lot of institutional knowledge and experience on the staff. So we've got a lot of new professionals, which is exciting in a lot of ways, but also we're doing a lot of mentoring, a lot of training. So it's an interesting time. I miss the retirees, I can tell you, every day, though I'm glad for them that they're retired and enjoying their retirement.
Do you feel like you're in good position, though, to move forward and not be in a kind of a constant state of turnover and flux?
I think with the part-timers, it's really hard because there's so many places that are really looking for part-time folks, and there's a lot of competition in the wages. So for us to be able to keep up with that is very difficult. We are not currently paying what McDonald's around the corner pays, on our lowest rung. So that's a real challenge. But, we're also a government organization, and our ability to raise salaries is limited. So it's a challenge. It's something we're talking about a lot.
Anna Canino-Flute, maybe a kind of a different question as a librarian at Volmer Elementary School, but are there, you think, fewer people sticking around, staying, or interested in the profession right now?
I think a lot of people, like anybody who's involved in education, whether you're a librarian like me or a teacher, is feeling an extreme amount of burnout. And a lot of us are feeling like this is not what we signed up for. So even though you're putting in all the effort, you can see why somebody who's a para coming in at a low wage position might choose not to do this, especially with a lot of us, especially in elementary, we're working with a population that only just now had the access to vaccines. So especially we used to have a lot of retirees who'd do subbing or who'd come in to be clerks and all that kind of stuff. And those kind of people were like, we're going to wait till your kids are vaccinated.
Listeners have been sharing a lot with us, and I want to share some of what they are sharing about libraries here. And I'll just read a bunch here. Carol says, just a comment. I love the library. I use it regularly. I've used an e-reader before. Good for long travel, but certainly I prefer real books. Thanks for highlighting this issue. In fact, prior to the show, I was off to the library. I mainly use the Greece one, and it is excellent. Go libraries. Again, first time we've had the phrase go libraries on the show, but I endorse it. Kat says, just for your information, Evan, ghosting that can occur is frequently due to requirements for people who collect unemployment. They have to apply to continue to get unemployment, but they don't necessarily have to follow up. Okay, possibly. Fair enough. Phil says, I was about 50-50 digital books and physical books, all digital since COVID. I've read about 120 books during COVID. That is a lot of books, and that's a lot of digital books. Ellie says, do I still use the library? Of course. I go weekly, if not more. What wonderful resources that they, especially with so many of them eliminating fines, equalizing access for so many who might have avoided them previously for just that reason. Thank you, Ellie. Mm-hmm. Adam, eliminating fines. What's the state of fines right now?
Sure. So there are public libraries across the county that have eliminated fines for children's and young adult material. There have also been some libraries who have some more elimination like policies that are usually time specific. So maybe they'll run it for a month and say, if you bring in a canned good for a food drive, for example, we may have fine amnesty, for example. But across the county, it kind of depends on which library you use and what their specific programs and goals are.
Okay. And overall here, how would you describe the purpose and mission of these debates about fines?
I think the mission or the debate that's happening is I think originally fines were set up as a disincentive or potentially maybe an attempt to try and reinforce some personal responsibility when borrowing or when using, you know, collective property, so to speak, because essentially this is, you know, a collection that's paid for by our taxes. On the other side of that, there are calls to eliminate barriers to access. Mm-hmm. And looking at those fines as a barrier, as saying, for example, if I take a item out from the library, what if I don't have reliable transportation back to the library to return it? And am I going to risk the fines that are incurred as a result of that? So I think that, you know, the talk about fine elimination or reduction is really the balance between how do we protect that collective property against how do we eliminate barriers to access?
What percentage of books that get taken out never come back?
Ooh, I don't have that off the top of my head. It's pretty low, though. In fact, I think it was Brooklyn Public just announced as part of their fine elimination that they've actually had better results after fine elimination of returning books. So after an elimination, they actually see better return of those materials.
Don't you love it when the outcome is opposite of what you expect? It's always interesting. Dennis in Rochester, I'll take your phone call in a second. I want to hear our other guests on this issue because it's not just about fines. We all have horror stories of being scared to show our face in one of your childhood libraries because you forgot some book somewhere and Dracula's a pain in the neck became thousands of dollars and an APB for me. But the reality is I understand why this has become a question on equity, on access. Laura, how do you see this one?
Well, I mean, when I was little, I always returned my books on time, so it wasn't an issue for me. But I think, you know, it really is... I see it as an equity issue, and you can look at any type of library that imposes fines. You know, if you're, or even something like if you're at a college and you don't return your library materials, you can have your diploma delayed, which is just bananas, you know? And so I think we need to reshape this conversation around what is the goal of these fines, and can we achieve this in some other way?
Adrian, how do you see it?
So, you know, I grew up in one of those homes where it was difficult to stay organized and stay on a schedule and get books back on time. I had overdue fines constantly when I was a kid, but I was a huge reader. And so for me, seeing those fines start to decrease makes my inner child very happy, you know, because I was always scared when I went to the library, but very determined. So I would go up and I'd be like, I know I owe money. But the very generous librarians out at the Seymour Library in Brockport, where I grew up, always let me check out my books. And what a life changer. Look at where I am. I'm sitting in a library right now. This is my career. So that stuff matters, you know, and it's particularly troubling to me to punish children for things that are largely out of their control. So I'm glad to see that conversation happening. It's something we talk about here. There's economic realities around that in terms of when you reduce fines, there is less money. So how do you deal with that? But I feel like I know that that's something that I would like to figure out and that we're always working on here.
Anna, what do you think?
Well, our district eliminated fines several years ago for students, and it has only been positive. It was easier for us to do it because we never actually got the money from the fines. It would go into the general fund. So it's not like it affected our bottom line. It didn't replace the book. And it just removed an adversarial situation with children. Like, I feel like our library should be a safe space. They're not being graded in the library, and I don't want to hassle them for something. Often they don't have control. Like you said, we have students who are living in unstable situations. They maybe were at grandma's last week. Now they're at an uncle's. And that book got lost in between. You know what? I just tell them, tell me if it's missing. And if you can't find it, I'll take it off the account. And if you do find it, bring it back. And that brightens up their interaction so much. And we actually also eliminated the amount of books that you can take out. So my kids, I always tell them, you can take as many books as you need. If you're a big reader, walk out of here with 10 books. If you are a kid who's like, I'm going to read it in between soccer practice, then, you know, take a couple. But we find that also liberates the kids of like, I can take as much as I need. That means I can take a book for me that I'm reading at home, not just one from reading in my classroom. I can have my research materials, and they're just free to be able to enjoy.
Great perspective here. Let me get Dennis in Rochester on the phone. He's been waiting. Hi, Dennis. Go ahead.
Hey, guys, great conversation. And my wife will be so mad that she can't hear this while she's at work today because she's a librarian. One last quick comment regarding the staffing issues around the library. She just left as a librarian in the Rochester City library system to go back to an elementary school. And it really was about the pay and the opportunity, because as everybody on this call probably knows, you can't be a librarian without a master's degree. Around here, you can get a master's degree in two different places, and we're looking at about 100 grand plus in debt. Librarians in the city can only get 20 hours a week. So you're working a master's degree with 20 hours a week, and all the student loan forbearance stuff is about to end. We felt like she had no choice. She had to kind of move on and go back to where she can get full-time pay and a better pay situation in the school system. So I know that there's challenges with budgeting, with staffing. You know, at one point they felt in her library like they were operating more as a community center or even a crisis center. They were being asked to do things that would be done in mental health clinics and things. So it's like very taxing. The librarians work so freaking hard, and you know, it's just a tough situation for a lot of them to make ends meet and make it viable to keep working.
Yeah, I mean, Dennis, part of the notes that we put together, and producer Megan Mack has a long experience in libraries, library science, et cetera, just threw a note on here saying, you know, just be aware, staffs are in some places have been exhausted and stressed. Burnout is a problem, even in library systems, yes. And you're saying the same thing, Dennis. I don't know if people appreciate that, but I'm glad you called. But how's she doing now?
It's just as stressful. Now we're helping children who have been away from school for a year and a half acclimate to the building again. And somebody mentioned it earlier, but it might have been you, about how they have to take on extra responsibilities in the school library. They don't get as many teacher's aides as the regular teachers do. My wife, her Chromebook cart got commandeered by the main office because they had a Chromebook crisis, so she doesn't have Chromebooks in her library. Lots of little logistical challenges, but I mean, ultimately, she loves her work, and she studied hard to reach her dream job, and she's doing it. So
that's great. I appreciate the perspective. Wish her well for us. Thank you, Dennis.
Thanks, guys.
And on that subject of just burnout, I have some nods around here. Anything you want to add that?
Yes, it's all true. I mean, who isn't burnout right now across every walk of life and every industry? But I think particularly to the caller's point about libraries acting in different capacities than they had in the past, you know, being a social worker, helping people with health information, it's exhausting, and it's you're constantly having to learn new skills and think on your feet. And so, you know, it's easy to understand why library staff would be overwhelmed at this point.
What do you think? Let me just ask all of our guests. Adam Traub, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think an unintended consequence of so many offices shutting down meant that the library, just like before the pandemic, but especially now, so the library is the last place where people can go to get help. So frequently at many libraries across the county, people are getting help applying for government benefits or for jobs, and they may not have had access before, or there may have been another office that would have helped them. And so our staff, who may have done some of that, are doing just that much more. And so, yeah, I think we're all feeling stretched thin.
Adrian?
You know, we opened a library here not long before the pandemic hit. In July of 2019, we opened. So that was this huge transition, right? And then 8 months later, boom, pandemic, everything changed. So everybody who's been through that process, that is just a lot in a really condensed period of time. And then, you know, all of this, I felt like, you know, I became a public health official. You know, it's a public building and I'm trying to figure out what's safe and what's not with minimal guidance. And that piece has been very stressful. And certainly we see a lot, not a lot, we see some of what a lot of organizations see. We have some common sense rules here for how to handle things during the pandemic, and people want to have an argument about it or are very resistive to following the rules. And that part is extremely exhausting and also frightening.
Mm. Anna, how do you see burnout as an issue in your profession?
Well, because teachers have never stopped working, and I think anybody who goes into teaching or into library science, you're a natural helper. You want to be there for people. You want to be able to get them to where they need to be. So that's just meant that people have been overperforming for a long period of time. And then there's more, because then you're like, you know, right now, I'm lucky enough that my principal said, yeah, you go in the back room, do your call. But in the past, this week, I've been a PE teacher. I filled in for another teacher at the end of the period, because we're just that short. So, and we also want to back each other up. So we've tried to pick up the slack for other people. So I think, yeah, definitely. Everybody's just like, wow, we're going to do this. And the longer we do it, we're now very tired.
We are grateful. Anna Canina Flute is a librarian at Vollmer Elementary School. Adrian Pettinelli, director of the Henrietta Public Library. Adam Traub, associate director of the Monroe County Library System and Central Library. Laura Osterhout is executive director of the Rochester Regional Library Council. And after we take this only break, interesting questions and feedback from listeners. First of all, Andy says, the best day of the week for us is Library Day for my three-year-old and I. My daughter and I get 4 books a week. It's helped tremendously. She can sit through chapter books at this point. She's read and listened to me dictate more than 10 chapter books already. Go libraries. Andy, that's awesome, and I know our guests are going to love hearing that. And MJ wonders if books are eventually going the way of vinyl. I don't think books are as extinguished as vinyl was to make a comeback, but maybe in the future books will be sort of viewed as kind of retro cool in the same way that vinyl is. And Marcy wants to know, what are kids reading these days? In other words, what's popular right now with kids? What are they voluntarily picking out? So we'll ask our guests if they want to weigh in with that. We got holiday season coming up. You need gift ideas. Everybody should be giving kids books. That's a good idea. So let's continue after this only break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, Rock the Future is getting ready to release its annual State of Our Children report. This year, it's just about a decade-long summary showing areas of progress and what needs further work. We'll talk about it. In our second hour, A Wild Idea. It's the title of a new book telling the story of the birth of the Adirondack Park Agency and the drama that ensued between environmentalists and private landowners. We'll talk about it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. MJ is wondering if in the future, books, even predicting that books, especially slightly older ones, will become like vinyl, highly collected and sought after. I think that's sort of cool and sort of depressing. Like it indicates that books have to sort of collapse before they could be cool again. But I take the point that MJ is making. We are moving ever slowly more into a digital world. I don't know, Anna Canino Flute. Are books eventually going to be viewed the way we look at vinyl?
I think it's just different. I mean, they're already elite editions of certain things, you know, like you can get spray painted edges and specially engraved covers, all available in like book crates with all their swag. So there's already that. And I think certain things are just going to be less popular in print form. Like a majority of our research collection is digital because that's accessible all the time. And like I turn to buy books that I can, we were talking about sharing at the beginning of the hour, but that are available for every student in that classroom. So when I used to have one book about dolphins, they have a multi-use digital copy of dolphins, right? So those are things that digital just does better in certain things. But yeah, we already have fancy editions and coveted editions. And yeah, just go to like Illuminate and Book Crate and go to town seeing how fancy those books can go.
I should have known already. Adrian, do you think books are going to go the way of vinyl?
You know, the thing about vinyl is you can't throw it in a backpack, right? You can't stick it in a pocket. And I think that's an advantage that books are always going to have. I think part of the reason vinyl went away is because it wasn't very user-friendly in a lot of ways. But a book is a very user-friendly format for what it is. It can take a lot of abuse. It does what it needs to do. So I don't see it going that way.
Okay. Adam Traub, do you see that? I was in an antique store last weekend, and they had big sections on vinyls. First thing I want to say is, what was happening in the 1970s? What collectively was happening besides all of the drug consumption that clearly was manifesting on album covers? The pictures were amazing that people thought would be very marketable. Peter Frampton, I'm looking at you, man. What was going on there? But it was interesting because those were very popular sections of the antique store. Is that what a physical book is going to be for our grandkids, grandkids? Are they going to think, oh, cool, look, physical books?
I don't know. As someone who collects vinyl, and not just because it was cool, because I grew up with it, I think that reading a book, written and oral storytelling is a very intimate experience. And I don't know that we have the technology yet to replace that. Will it happen someday? Possibly. I don't know. I haven't thought up the technology. I haven't heard Zuckerberg's Meta has come up with it yet. Ooh. But until then, I don't know that there's much to really replicate that experience. Now, I will say, back to something Anna mentioned about the research collection, certainly in academic libraries, research journals and specifically articles are the primary driver, and making those digitally available is a much more accessible way to make that available, as opposed to going out and getting the journal. Because if you take that journal out, you've got 12, 10 articles all taken out that no one else can read. Whereas if it's online, you can all access those as needed. But when you're talking about a novel or a nonfiction piece, there's nothing yet that will replicate that intimate experience, I think.
Laura, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I can speak from being a parent of a 12-year-old who is on a screen all day long, mm-hmm. and his choice is to be on video games most of the time. But when it's time for him to read, he puts that stuff down and he picks up a physical book. And I asked him, and he said, I like to hear the story in my head, And there's something really powerful about that inner voice you have.
When you're reading a physical book.
Yep.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a great little piece of insight.
Yeah.
I also think, my 9-year-old likes video games too. My measure for the impact of video games and screens and whether they're too sort of pernicious is, do kids want to fully abandon going outside or reading books in favor of them? And as long as the answer is no, you could probably find a balance.
Yep.
Roughly agree with that?
Yep, definitely.
I mean, that's the world that kids are growing up in.
It is.
Marcy was asking, what are kids reading these days? So what I guess that is, sort of what's popular or interesting. I don't know if anything comes to mind. Laura, any series or specific books that are cool with kids right now?
It's hard to follow what my kid is doing. He's into manga a lot, and he's working his mm-hmm. way through the whole Harry Potter series, so we've got those all lined up on the shelf. But I'll defer to maybe Anna and Adrian, who work with kids more than I do.
Okay. Anna Canino Flute, let me start with you. What are kids into these days, books-wise?
Oh, as soon as that question came through, I started doodling on my pad here. Number one, we're having Kwame Alexander come as a virtual Aussie visit at the end of the month, and his books are just completely flying out of our library. They're written in verse, but there are things about basketball and soccer and just life and grief. And I have a teacher doing a read aloud, and the kids groan every time they're done. So, yeah, those kind of books are very popular. Lauren Tarse's I Survive series, Resurrection from the Days of When I Was a Kid, The Babysitter's Club are huge, both in graphic novel form, and now they're reissued with the fun cartoon covers. And those video gamers, they come in and get books from us, too. We have Animal Crossing, cheat books, and Minecraft how-tos, and Fortnite, and Roblox. And those are always flying off our shelves.
Babysitters, the Babysitters Club, that's old school.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I love it.
I was a 10-year-old. That was the first English book. Spanish is my first language, and Babysitter's Club was the first book I read completely in English. So, yeah, it's so funny to me that they're coming and they're reading the same stories. They've been updated, but they always had diversity, characters of color and characters with illnesses. So those all still connect today.
Very cool. Somebody's going to tell me that kids are still reading The Celery Stalks at Midnight. I loved that book, probably because dad jokes, you know, like puns.
That was a great book.
I know. Remember? I mean, I don't remember if it was any good.
The
kid version of me loved it. So, I think that's very cool. Adrian, what are kids into?
Well, I mean, certainly the Benicula books are still popular.
Oh, yes.
Great favorites of mine, too. Those are great read-alouds, too, if you've got a 5 or 6-year-old at home who wants to hear a read-aloud. Those are just classic. In newer authors, in picture books, we see some great illustrators like Christian Robinson is a real favorite who gets a lot of play. Mo Willems, mm-hmm. goes between the picture books and the beginning readers. He does a great job bridging those, and kids just flock to those books. The graphic novels and manga do well with kids and teens, just almost anything. Raina Tagelmeyer's been really killing in that area. She just has lots of books. I've read a few of them. They're great. I texted my children's librarian. She said the 13-story treehouse is really big right now. Mm. That was mm-hmm. something she mentioned. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I remember the 13-story treehouse and the 26-story treehouse and the third. It's like mm-hmm. multiples of 13, if I recall. My son was into those a couple years ago. And anything you want to add on this, Adam?
I'll defer
you
to
defer
my
to the
friends
experts.
Who work, yeah.
Well, here's one that I think, Adam, you ought to talk a little bit about before the hour's up here. A listener called in off-air to say they're stressing books, which are great, but they're not talking about the wonderful programs they have, like Eastman Musicians come to the library, mm-hmm. other services, et cetera. You've talked a little bit about that, but this caller says they ought to be bragging about the non-book things that libraries do. So go ahead.
Sure. I mean, the programs are phenomenal, and I know that that's been one thing that libraries across the county have been working really hard to bring back, bring back author speaking series. I know Adrian had a great one not too long ago with a children's author, bringing in artists to do art talks or, writing workshops. I think those programs are really what we've been missing, too. And we're really trying to get rebooted and make sure that we're holding them in a way that people feel safe. So sometimes that means Zoom, and sometimes that may mean holding them in person or outdoors or whatever kind of adjustments we need to make. But yeah, the non-book stuff is certainly fantastic, and we're bringing it back as we can.
Laura, you want to add to that?
Sure. I mean, there's so many non-book programs and services by all kinds of libraries, but one that just came to mind is the Monroe County or the Monroe Community College. They actually have a food cupboard in their library for their students that are food insecure. So you just think about all the needs that someone might have when they walk into any library, and libraries attempting to meet them where they are. I think it's amazing.
Mm. Adrian Pettinelli, can you add to that?
Yeah, we've actually started having events in person again. We've been dipping our toe into that. We were doing everything on Zoom, and boy, people are ready to come out. We had a great lecture last week on Elsa von Blumen, a local athlete, early from the 1900s, early 1900s, late 1800s. And we had 27 people come out on kind of a yucky Thursday night to come and see that lecture, and it was great. And so we're really seeing that interest, and that's a lot of fun for us to bring in all these different speakers. So,
and Anna, anything you want to add there?
Yeah, like in our libraries, we all have like maker supplies and maker spaces. Mm-hmm. I used to run a maker club, and you have kids who are hungry for that. So we have kids who come down on recess and work with our makers' tools. And I see that all around in all the other school libraries in this region, is that we have given the kids an opportunity to make things with their hands. And they really, really get excited about that.
Well, in our last minute or so, we've had a great hour talking about the state of libraries and the future of libraries. But, there may be a future sometime where we don't see libraries in the way that we see them now. I hope that they're not extinct in the way that maybe predictions were a couple of decades they'd be. They provide all these great services beyond books. But Laura, what needs to happen to make sure libraries are strong well into the future?
Well, I mean, funding. Funding is great. But I think, you know, another, you asked earlier, like, what's a good thing that might have come out of the pandemic for libraries? And the point that now sort of the average person is understanding the value of the work that libraries do to support people that need access to, you know, information is hard to deal with. And you do need some expertise in order to get at the things that you, that are going to help you move forward in your personal, professional life. And so I, you know, I just think that that's, that will always be what libraries are doing. And I'm happy to see people recognizing it. And even our legislators now are really putting more emphasis on that. And we're maybe going to see some more funding coming through to support these types of activities.
I think it's a great way to close the hour. And I'm grateful for the time. Laura Osterhout is Executive Director of the Rochester Regional Library Council. Thank you for being with us.
You got it.
Our thanks to Adam Traub, Associate Director of the Monroe County Library System and Central Library. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Great way to end the week with Anna Canino-Flute, a librarian at Volmer Elementary School. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
And Adrian, the celery stalks at midnight. Beware. Adrian Pettinelli is the Director of the Henrietta Public Library. Thank you, Adrian.
Oh, thanks so much.
And listeners, great feedback and a lot of love for libraries on this Friday afternoon. Maybe that's where you're heading now, but wherever you're going to be, hope you have a great weekend. And from Megan Mack, who did everything today, wrote all the notes on the libraries, produced the show, engineered the show, should have just hosted the show. But that's what I did. The whole team here saying thanks for listening. We're grateful for you every day, and we'll talk to you next week on Member Supported Public Radio.